Okay, today is November 11th, and it's the 8th of Kislev, 5774. We're just into the new month of Hanukkah, which is the holiday of light, of course, in the dark time. It got really dark, really fast, right? So, I wanted to talk tonight about how there is a tendency of the mind to feel that it's overqualified for the spiritual task at hand, right? Because of the spiritual work consists of being aware of the obvious, then then the mind is overqualified. The mind feels that it wants to. It's much more powerful than that. You know, it can figure things out. It can expand beyond the obvious and go to what it perceives to be deeper, what it perceives to be wider. It doesn't have to be locked to the prison of the present moment and what you're experiencing in the present. Your mind can travel infinitely beyond that. You know, the imagination is the limit. So the mind feels that it's like, I think that there's a, not necessarily a conscious sense of it, but there's an attitude inherent within our ability to think that says, I shouldn't be wasting my time with the obvious. Because my whole reason to exist is to probe with thought and to go beyond the obvious. And that's true, that is its existence. And so to make the deliberate effort to bend the mind down into the present out of its glory, you know, out of its genius, and to bend it into the obvious, into that which there's no arguing about. Right? The mind is like, if you can't argue about it, then the mind has nothing to do. I was at a party the other night for the boy who had his bar mitzvah ceremony on Saturday. And the family had this party, and we went to it on Saturday night after Shabbat. Very beautiful party in their house, which was in tremendous contrast to the bar mitzvah party we went to in Miami the weekend before. And you could really tell by these parties the difference between Miami and Berkeley, culturally speaking. And it was very sweet. And a woman who's a teacher here, we were sitting and eating, and she was just asking me something about how I teach meditation and things like that to preteens, you know, which is very challenging, obviously, you know. And so I was trying to, you know, we're kind of talking about that, and there was somebody who was listening who was kind of overhearing what we were saying, and he kind of jumped in. He said, well, he said, I think I have a much more concrete way of talking about all that. And I said, oh, wow, okay. Let me hear it. And when someone says more concrete, I get excited, you know. And he said, well, I think religion is just, you know, it's just people trying to understand what they can't understand, so they make up stories. And, you know, in the past it created group cohesion and blah, blah, blah. He just kind of started talking and talking and talking and talking. And it was all just kind of the mind justifying his aversion to religion, right? And, you know, and then, of course, a million different responses to what he was saying came up in my mind, you know. And so I tried to engage him a little bit, you know, in the argument, and in a friendly way, you know. And so he kind of engaged back, but his mind sort of skipped to a completely different topic, and he started throwing those things out, you know. And it was just a great illustration of what the mind wants to do, The mind wants to play with ideas and to argue about ideas and even get identified with ideas, so that if you can make your point, then that reinforces your sense of self. And that gets to why the mind's bending down into what is obvious is actually a supreme act of humility. Because the mind has to let go of what it does best to do that. So it's a kind of humility. And humility means that the ego, the sense of self, is able to step out of the way. And once the ego is stepping out of the way, then ironically, or paradoxically, maybe is the right word, then you can actually bring forth from within yourself something that's even higher than the mind. So that's the paradox, is that by the mind stepping down off its throne and bending to a place that it perceives to be lower, meaning just physical reality, just what's happening in the physical world around you in this moment, then you actually get to bring forth from in yourself something that's higher than the mind. And so there's an affinity between the highest and the lowest, and the middle stuff is where the ego lives. You might make a rule out of that. It's like a good thing to just remember in the midst of life, you know, that if you want to bring forth the highest in yourself, then go to the lowest point in yourself. Right? And by higher and lower, of course, that's just a metaphor, a spatial metaphor. But by higher and lower, what I mean is higher means transcendent consciousness, which is not trapped by ego, which is not trapped by drama, which is not concerned really even about the circumstances of your life. It doesn't really care. It's okay with whatever because it doesn't have a self that it's trying to, it is not a self, I should say, that is trying to perpetuate itself or defend itself or protect itself or get itself, maneuver itself into a good position, which is what we want to do as egos. The higher self or the awareness that's transcendent beyond the ego is free from all that. And so that's what I mean by higher. And by lower, what I mean is that which is not aware of itself because it doesn't have a self either, because it's not even developed to that point yet. It's just physical. It's just the body breathing, and it's just inanimate stuff around you. You know, it's just what's happening in the world of the senses. So, you know, in Kabbalah that's mapped out in terms of four worlds, the highest world being transcendent consciousness, and the lowest world being the physical, right? And in between those, we have the mind's thought with thinking, and then we have the world of the emotions, the heart. And that's where the ego lives, is in those two things. That's not to say that those two things are bad or somehow we can throw them away. Those, of course, have to be integrated, and you couldn't even understand what I'm talking about right now without the mind also. So it's not to demonize the mind or anything. It's just to say that in order for the mind and the heart to be functioning at a high level, we have to bring forth the highest level from within ourselves. And to bring forth the highest level, we have to pay attention to the lowest level. That's how you do it. You don't do it by paying attention to the highest level, because the thing that is able to pay attention to the lowest level is the highest level. The mind doesn't want to pay attention to the lowest level. That's not its job. Its job is to think about stuff, figure stuff out. So if the mind commits this act of humility, of getting out of the way, of relaxing its constant activity enough so that you can be present with the lowest level, be present with what's actually going on rather than what's going on in our imagination, then you can bring forth from within yourself, or that's just a way of saying it. You can get a sense of what the deepest potential is within you, the deepest potential, which is free and from which can come a higher level of response in your thoughts and in your emotions. Because you can't, how can you get a higher level of response in your thoughts and your emotions if you're trapped in your thoughts and your emotions, if you're trapped in the patterns? There has to be a part of yourself that's not trapped, that's free from it, in order for something new to flow in and for some kind of transformation to happen on the level of how we live and our responses and so on. So I think there's a hint of this in the verse that I've been singing with the congregation lately. We have a new melody for this verse. It's in the Elenu. We can look at it when we do the davening later. The verse is, V'yadata hayom v'hashivota ela v'vecha. You should know today and return to your heart. Ki Hashem hu ha'elokim v'shamayim ima'av al ha'aretz mitachat ein od. That the Hashem, which means beingness, which means existence, Hu Ha Elohim, it is the God, or it is the power. Bashamayim Ima'al, in the heavens above, right, at the highest level. Bashamayim Ima'al Va'al Ha'aretz Mitachat, and on the earth below. Ein Od, and there is actually nothing else. There is actually nothing else. There's just what? There's just Hashem. There's just the beingness. There's just existence on all these different levels. But it mentions in the heavens above and on the earth below, because those are the key things. If we want to be in touch with Hashem in the heavens above, which is an image that kind of implies that you have a perspective that's above your life, that's beyond all your problems. You know, it's like if you look at the earth from a spaceship and you see the earth there, you know, there's that. I remember reading something from an astronaut that saw that, and the effect that it had on him the first time he saw the earth like that. And it was just such a profoundly different perspective on the earth. And psychologically, you know, when we are physically above the earth, when we can actually see our lives down below, like by being up on a mountain or in an airplane or something, it kind of can trigger a little bit of that effect psychologically of being above, being transcendent, not being trapped. But how do you do it? You could go up into outer space and have that profound effect, you know, profound experience looking at the earth, or you could go in the opposite direction. Meaning, go inward, contract your mind, humble your mind from its fantasizing about what's going on in life, and actually come to what's really going on in life right now. So there's an affinity between the highest and the lowest. Another way to say it, and we'll do just hold on, just few minutes ago. Another way to say it is that the most contracted is the most expansive. Mm-hmm. Or there's an affinity between the most expansive and the most contracted. In the act of remembering, oh, all of this suris that I'm experiencing is all a product of my mind. Does that mean that there's not stuff going on out there that I'm upset about? No, it doesn't. It doesn't mean it's imaginary. But what it means is it's that it's the imagination of it that is causing the tsuris. It's not the actual anything that's going on. It's only the way we hold it in our mind that creates the sense of disturbance, sense of being trapped, or the sense of burden, sense of holding a burden. And so it may feel temporarily like a discipline, like I have to contract my mind into the present or into what's happening. But once you can cross that barrier and actually get in touch with what's really happening in the moment, then all of a sudden you realize it's not actually a contraction, it's this tremendous expansion. But it's a contraction for the thinking mind. But it's an expansion for your life energy. And so how do you do it? How do you return to your heart? In other words, really internalize deeply into your heart this truth that the God in the heavens is the same as the God in the earth below. You know, that there's a... to achieve the highest, you bring yourself to the lowest. How do you know it? It says in the very beginning of the verse, V'yadata hayom, that you should know it today. Today is a metaphor for the present, that you can only know it by doing it right now. You can't know it by understanding it as a practice you're going to do sometimes. You can only do it by knowing it right now. So as a last little piece, when we're doing the prayers, like we'll do in a little while, we'll do the Maariv evening prayer, and it can be very helpful as you're doing it to constantly bring yourself into the moment of what you're doing. So each word that you're saying, bringing yourself into intimate connection with the word that you're saying. Let yourself be fully in whatever moment of the prayer we're in. And the form of the prayers that's preconceived, that's written in the book that we're following, is like something you can rely on. It's something you can take refuge in a sense. That you can relax and let the flow of the prayers take you where it wants to take you. As opposed to getting into a kind of egoic relationship with it, where you love like, oh, I don't know these Hebrew words, or I don't know if these words jive with me, or I don't understand, or, you know, there's all these things, all these tricks that the mind can play once we start interacting with a traditional form. But to be aware of that, to know that when now that happens, that's actually just the triggering of the mind's natural tendency of what it always does. And so it becomes a template for being aware of that and practicing bringing yourself back into reality. And trusting that reality as it is just what it is. It doesn't require your mind's judging it. Like it will reveal something much more deep than your mind's idea of it being good or bad. I don't want to say, oh, it's all really good, because that's all just the mind's idea of good. Mm-hmm. But what life reveals once the mind is not judging it as good and bad is something that we can't even say in words. It's something far more profound and interesting than, you know, than our ordinary ideas of good and bad. So we can open it up.
Can you give an example? You're talking about the higher and the lower. So can you give an example of kind of maybe an everyday kind of struggle or something, and where you're going to do that?
Well, I think that there's two kinds of ways that we experience struggle. in day-to-day life. I mean, there's lots of different ways, but I'm going to divide it into two different ways for simplicity. One is when you're actually involved with something which you perceive to be the source of the struggle. So, meaning like, I don't know, I'm just going to say, if I'm trying to get my kids to go to bed and it's not working out so well, then I can perceive that dynamic itself is the struggle. Or if I'm, you know, trying to make it back to my house in time for a piano lesson like today, and there was all this work on the roads going on, so I couldn't actually get to my street, and they wouldn't even let me turn on my street, that would have been an opportunity to feel like I'm in a struggle. If I chose to go down that path. Or if I didn't choose and just unconsciously went down that path, because no one would really choose to go down that path, right? So, unless they were doing an experiment, I guess. But so that's one time that struggle happens, when you're engaged with something that you perceive to be the source of your struggle. The other thing is when you are not doing anything that's particularly a struggle. You're just walking from one place to the other. You're eating your breakfast, or whatever, you're just doing stuff that in and of itself, there's no inherent elements that you would perceive to be your struggle, and yet you are imposing on it some bigger life context that you're struggling with. Right? You're doing something simple, but in your mind, you're struggling with something. And so then everything becomes a struggle. Because the mind is imagining how the whole thing could be different in a better way, and you're not happy that it is as it is, right? So those would be like two, broadly speaking, like two ways in which we can be in struggle. The second way is like a little bit more simple. Because all it requires, really, is that we become aware that our mind is doing that. And then simply take on the practice of bringing our minds into a humbling, bending down into the actual present. Into whatever it is that we're really doing. As long as we can become aware that we are creating the struggle with our mind. You know, that it doesn't actually exist anywhere except in our mind. That's the trick, is just knowing that. Is just remembering that. You know, remembering it, but remembering it also for long enough with enough intention to be able to allow the transformation to start to happen. Because if you remember it for a moment and then just go right back to it, then obviously that doesn't really do anything for you. But if you remember it and say, okay, there's this momentum, this fire burning within me to keep this struggle going. I see that. I am not going to choose that. Okay, I still feel it. It's very intense, but I'm not going to choose that. What am I going to choose instead? I'm going to choose this rich palette that's already here. I don't have to make it up. I don't have to invent some. I don't have to even remember any particular scriptural words or do any affirmations or anything like that. All I have to do is just bring myself to what's actually here. Bring myself to the richness of what's happening in this moment. Because in every moment, there's all this richness happening that we're ignoring in order to go off and have the struggle in our minds and in our emotions and our hearts, too. It's being stormy inside. And as soon as you start, if you can sustain it, this gentle redirecting of yourself, you know, and it has to be gentle, because if it's forceful, then it has the same energy as the struggle, then all of a sudden you're in a struggle with that too. But if it's kind of homeopathic, you know, gentle, just a gentle reorienting, then there's a shift. And in that shift, even the storminess looks a little different, right? because now you're not really judging the storminess. You're not really trying to get rid of the storminess. You're just seeing that the storminess doesn't have to be ruling you. You don't really have to be buying into it. You don't really have to try to get rid of it. You just have to kind of just a very gentle reorientation, simply by knowing and recognizing and being willing. You know, so that's extremely powerful, and profound, and very, very simple. And the first thing, though, when you're actually engaged with something that you perceive as a struggle, then it's a little more complicated, because you still have to do the first thing. You know, you still have to realize that you're engaging, that you're creating a struggle in your mind, and so on. You still have to do all that. But then you also have to ask the question within yourself, how else can I interact with a situation that doesn't perpetuate this dynamic of struggle and instead brings, you know, demonstrates wisdom, you know, some kind of wisdom that will come from a higher level, a more wise level, a more compassionate level than where I currently am. You know, you have to ask that question. And, you know, an answer may or may not come in that moment. So, but there's that other step to it. And it's also trickier because when you're engaged with a thing that you perceive as a source of struggle, then it's less likely you're really going to remember to do that, and because the thing is happening in the moment. Whereas, like, when you're creating it yourself in your mind, then there's nothing really to distract you except your own mind. So you can, it's a lot easier in a sense. And so for that second thing, you know, there are little techniques that can be very helpful. They're actually the techniques that they're talking about in this new project that Chochmat HaLev is getting involved with, called the Tikkun Midot Project. Have you heard about that? So there's a practice called Musar. Mm-hmm. You've heard of Musar. So Musar is a Jewish practice of focusing on particular character traits. So it's kind of like breaking down spirituality into different components. And I don't tend to work that way. I've sort of avoided the whole Musar thing for a long time because to me all those different character traits just spring spontaneously from one source when you are aware, when you wake up. You don't necessarily have to focus on them one by one. However, I've been doing some training in this lately, and I went to the best place in the world, Newark, New Jersey, recently.
I was born.
Really? Yeah. Really? Wow. That's intense. And so we went to Newark, me and Jeffrey and Laura and Rabbi Sarlaya. And we did this training with this organization called the Institute for Jewish Spirituality, and they had this weekend thing, and we're supposed to do this year-long kind of study of it and then bring it in different ways into the community the following year. So it's this whole big project. But anyway, one of the things that I thought was really cool about it as I listened to their teachings and talking about it and so on is that they would focus on a particular thing, like a particular issue that any individual may have to work on in their life. It might be patience. You know, it might be, persistence. It might be loving kindness. You know, any of these like things associated with the spherot, you could do it that way, or you could do it any. And it doesn't even matter really. It just what matters is that you're taking a particular quality, and then you're going to make up an exercise for yourself to do for a set period of time. And so it's very different from the awareness work that I'm always talking about, because the awareness work that I'm talking about is I'm advocating doing it always forever. Like this is the main thing, always forever. But with the Tikkun Midot stuff, it's just the opposite. It's like you pick a particular exercise and you do it for a finite amount of time, but you make sure you do it every day in a particular way. And so the effect of it is that it's kind of homeopathic. It's like allows you to shed light on a particular pattern in your behavior and in your thinking and to just shift it slightly. The idea isn't to change your personality. And this, it was actually great when I heard this. I was really happy. Because I had the impression that Tikkun Mido sort of held up this ideal of what the personality was you're trying to go for, and now you're going to practice turning into this other person. I thought that was just kind of silly. But actually, that's not what they're doing, so I'm really what they're talking about is actually just doing these very gentle and subtle exercises so that you kind of plant a seed of awareness within yourself around certain patterns, and that I can see from how they were talking about it how that might kind of help you over time to untie the knots of those patterns. So I think those things could be useful, but the core of it is to take the time to contemplate on what those areas are when you're separate from them, when you're not in the dynamic, you know. So as part of your meditation and prayer and so on, also take a little time to contemplate, okay, so what's triggering me? What situations and dynamics are really triggering me? And let me think of a way that I can just behave the opposite in a certain way and practice that for the next week, for the next month. So those can be very powerful. They sort of tie you to a commitment of not getting drawn in the same way that you get drawn in normally. But I think still the key is just, this key is always consciousness. The more consciousness that you're generating, then the less power those things have over you, and the more energy you have to access to for something new to happen. Hope that's helpful.
So what kind of wisdom arose when you were late? For your piano lesson.
Well, there was nothing really I could do about it other than to call the person and tell them what was going on. But the truth is that I didn't really have the temptation in that moment to get upset about it or anything like that. But what I did notice is that when I had driven up to the street and the guy wouldn't let me in, he was kind of pissed off. Like, he wasn't like, sorry, can't come in now, we're doing... he was like, stop, get back, turn around, you know? So that, when he did that, then I noticed like this, what do you mean, turn, you know? I noticed that this energy come up in me that was like, well, you know, this reactive thing of like, but this is my street and there is no, because it was clear to me that he didn't realize there's no other way you can get into my street. You can't go around. He was yelling, go around, blah, blah, blah. But there is no around. It's a cul-de-sac. So, you know, so there was a little bit of that energy, and I didn't notice that the energy was there until after I finished the interaction and turned around. So that's why I said it's really, when you're in the moments of it, it's very difficult to see it, or, you know, maybe difficult's not even the right word. It's unlikely. It's maybe impossible sometimes. Because, you know, because I told him, I said, well, there is no around. This is the way in. And he kind of stopped for a minute, and he seemed like exasperated. And he said, give me 5 minutes, and then you can come back. I said, okay. And I turned around and called the person and so on. And after I turned around and stopped the car and was calling the person, I noticed, oh, there's this negative energy in me. Why am I so negative? Like, that's not like me to get so upset that I can't turn on my street. That's not a big deal, right? And I said, oh, it's because that guy was yelling at me. And I didn't even notice it while it was happening. I was just in the flow of it. And I said, oh, okay, that guy was yelling at me. So it wasn't really, it just was triggered within me from the situation. Okay, so there it is. There's this energy. So what? Doesn't have to. Once I was aware that it was there and aware that, you know, where it came from, there was nothing more really to worry about it. It's just something that came and it was part of the fabric of reality, part of what was happening. So I feel like it wasn't then problematic, you know. And that's a good example because that was easy, actually. So you can see it. But of course, in real life, there are many other examples that are far more difficult, where we fail again and again, you know, and go into unconscious places. But fortunately, no matter how unconscious we get, if we still want to get conscious, if we don't want to, that's another problem, then it's nothing, then you're lost. But if you want to, then you always can. You know, and part of the key that I'm talking about tonight is the key of humility. Because when we do get lost and we do get caught in unconscious patterns and feed all kinds of negative energies and so on, then the only way out of it really is to be humble, you know, to recognize our own faults or our own imperfections or the fact that we were stuck and maybe or we are stuck or whatever, and to just recognize that and surrender to it. Because if we're trying to kind of justify it or defend it, then we can't. That requires energy. That's like ego energy, ego maintenance energy. And we have to just kind of give up all that and admit where we are so that we can let it go and come back into the present. And that's the bringing of the light into the darkness. That's the Hanukkah theme too. And the other side of humility, of course, is gratitude, which is why the sphera in the Tree of Life, which is called Hod, is associated both with humility and with gratitude. Because Hod can actually mean both of those things. Because once there's a sense of humility, then in humility there's a letting go of taking things for granted. You know, there's a realizing that, oh, well, actually, I'm complaining about what I don't have and everything, but actually, look all that I do have, and that's not a given. It's not a given that any of us should be here and be, you know, functioning well enough to be sitting here tonight. It's not a given. That's a gift. You know? So, when we shift our awareness from complaining about stuff to realizing actually how good we have it in this moment, that we're so privileged actually, then that's a really profound reframing of everything too. So does anybody else want to share anything or
question? Yeah. You've used words which kind of triggered something.
Yeah.
Creating consciousness. I never thought about the power of creating it. I always thought it's either there or not. Mm. Could you kind of comment on that? What did you mean by creating consciousness?
Creating consciousness?
Yeah.
When did I say that?
Do
you remember what the context was?
About the choices.
Well, I think I might have said generating consciousness. Did I? Creating? I don't know.
Could be, still.
Yeah, I'm not sure if creating is necessarily the most accurate term, but I think what I meant was that our consciousness is constantly shifting form. Right, consciousness in a sense is, it's something that we are, right? We don't create it, it's something we are. But at the same time, the particular function that the consciousness is having in the moment is changing all the time. So if we are in a place of being stuck or generating drama or negativity or whatever, then our consciousness is taking the form of that, and it's involved with that, and it's believing that it is that. And in order to do that, the higher potential of consciousness is being usurped by that. So we don't have as much awareness when we are when our awareness is being used up in that type of activity. I mean, in a sense, the more we are creating an inner world, an inner imaginary world, which is what we tend to do all the time if we're not watching what we're doing. There's this inner world that just arises. And so there's this sense of two worlds all the time. There's the inner world that I'm imagining and making up all the time. And then there's the world going on around me, the outer world. So we have a sense of the inner world and the outer world. What's that?
Separation.
Yeah, and there's two different things. So there's less consciousness in a sense, the more we have our inner, the more strong our inner world is. I mean, inner world in a sense is not that different from a dream. You know, when you're dreaming, it's like that inner world that's always going on takes over completely. And then there is no more. You think that the inner world is the outer world when you're in the dream, right? And it takes on a life of its own, and it seems real when we're in it. And then when you wake up from the dream, you realize, oh, that wasn't real. What does that mean, it wasn't real? I mean, it was a real experience, right? You really felt like you were in that world. But when you feel the contrast between that and waking up from the dream, you have a sense, you have an intuitive realization that that is somehow just in your mind. Right? You might have different beliefs about what it means, but you know that it's not the same as this. Right? Once you wake up from it. So it's the same type of thing. There's a sense of waking up from the dream, which is waking up from the world of your mind. But then there's another level of waking up. And that happens when the inner world that's the norm for how you live your life can subside for long enough for you to see what life is like without it. If your consciousness is not being absorbed in this inner world as much, then all of a sudden everything looks completely different. It's like, oh, this is what it's like to be alive and be a person without this whole other thing going on. Like, reality is actually a lot more fresh and bright and interesting and amazing when that whole inner world isn't creating this imaginary dream drama. So to wake up from that means to generate more consciousness in a sense. But as a practice, you have to intentionally be conscious, and that means bringing your attention from the whole inner world into again, like I was saying, the lowest level, meaning just bring it into what's happening in the present. Because when you do that, you draw energy away from the inner world. So you can catalyze that shift through practicing being more conscious. Being more conscious means being more present, which means being aware of what's happening rather than what you're imagining is happening. Does that make sense? But another thing to know is that when you do that, if it doesn't seem amazing and revelatory and special right away, then your mind says, eh, let's get back to making this inner world. Let's get back to thinking. So that's why it takes a little bit of a leap of faith too, because the tremendous, beautiful experience of spiritual awakening is not something that happens all the time. You know, you have to, in a way, it takes a certain type of, it's beautiful when something like that does happen, but for many of us, it takes kind of a commitment to it so as to let this new perspective unfold gradually as it wants to unfold. And sometimes a person won't ever be interested in taking that leap until the inner world is painful enough. You know, like I've said this before, some people have very healthy, nice inner worlds, and so there's not much of a reason for them to wake up more. They can just go along and their personality is perfectly well for most of their lives. There's no interest, right? So in that sense, sometimes suffering can be a good catalyst for awakening, for becoming more conscious.
So do you think the idea of saying brachot for different activities during the day is like a way of connecting the lower to the higher?
Yeah.
Like
absolutely.
Before you eat,
yeah.
When you wash your hands,
mm-hmm.
When you see a beautiful sky,
yeah.
Etc. These are very simple acts,
mm-hmm.
And they don't. I mean, once you memorize the brahma, you don't have to employ a lot of mental apparatus. They're there.
Yeah, yeah. The brahma are ingenious because they become because as a religious practice that you then kind of just accept upon yourself and you just always do it, then they become very pronounced opportunities for becoming more conscious. It doesn't mean you actually, if you're a religious person in the external sense and you just do the brachot because you have been taught to, it doesn't mean you're actually becoming more conscious. You have to know the inner, you have to know that that's the opportunity to become more conscious and then do that. But if you have the two together, then that's very, very, very powerful because then you have this structure for it. You know, if you don't have the structure for it, then, you know, then you're just relying on your own kind of using different opportunities to become more conscious, remembering how to do that, which is also good and fine. But I love form and structure and, you know, and having opportunities that are incorporated, you know, into your life. I mean, that was something because I wasn't brought up religious at all or with any of these practices. And at a certain point in my life, I realized, well, why do I want to just keep living a life completely devoid of the structures of spirituality and just so that I'm just relying on my own intention to be conscious? Like, that's a very profound thing. That's the most profound thing, is to have that intention. But there's also this whole structure that's there to help with it. Like, why would I just avoid that? So it became like at a certain point, like, you know, it's like if you want to exercise physically, you want to become fit. You know, you could just say, well, I'm just gonna, you know, when I'm at my desk working, I'm gonna go like this. not my desk working, you know. And, I mean, that's cool, you know. And maybe you work somewhere. Maybe you can run to work. You could ride your bike to work. And maybe you can just become fit totally just by permaculture, just by doing it in the course of your life,
right.
You know. But for many of us, it's helpful to, like, learn certain exercises and commit to doing them, you know. It's just a different way.
I mean, a lot of people who were both in pseudo-religious environment, who developed extreme distaste for the structure.
Yeah, me
because
too.
Because for them, the structure replaced spirituality.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's very personal.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the structure can replace it. Yeah, there can be a sense that instead of actual, real spirituality, we're just going to do these things and
go through the motions.
And it's true, you know. And it's also true that the structures can become so complicated that the average person is not really able to use them spiritually. They're able to do the structures, but they're not actually be able to use them in a spiritual way. So it just becomes sort of hoops that you have to jump through that they do, and that's worth something. I mean, it's worth something to kind of put out the effort and to, you know, learn how to do that, but it's not necessarily being used as a spiritual practice. But then I'll also say that that's also not necessarily bad, because if they are the type of people that are giving themselves to it, then at a certain point they'll start absorbing the teachings of how to make it a real, because those teachings are constantly coming. They're being preached, they're being studied, they're being, you know. So, but a lot of people just, it's not going to work, and then they'll give it up, and then they'll have disdain for it because it was oppressing them. So, yeah, that's true. So, I just encourage everyone to find the right, not to disdain so much that you don't move forward with it or do anything, you know, but to take on what is useful to you, whatever the next thing is useful to you, to take it and experience it until you're ready for the next thing, you know, but to just to be engaged with it, you know, and ask yourself the question, what's the next step for me? Because there's always next steps, you know, for the highest sadhak, there's still a next step, so.
What is the main commitment? It's just a good starting point. It's what I'm trying to translate. This structure, or in a way, discipline,
commitment. The work?
Awareness. To bring awareness to your life, to daily life.
Right.
Yeah. I just want to know if I'm on the same page with...
Yeah, so...
The structure, or like the religious part.
Mm-hmm. You mean like the practices?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
A good starting point can be just commitment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The next level, I mean, it's maybe the stars, but the foundation, it's real commitment.
Right. Well, what's the commitment to? That's a good, you know, that's a good thing to, a good question to ask. What's the commitment to? But yeah, then if you have clarity about what the commitment is to, then that will guide all the subsequent steps, because you'll know what you're committed to, that you're continuing to walk on, what the path is, you know. So I would say, I mean, the way I would phrase it is that the commitment is to the spiritual path, and if it's from a Jewish point of view, and the commitment is to engaging with the Jewish spiritual path. So what that means specifically is going to be different for each individual because everybody has a different relationship with it. Mm-hmm. You know, it all depends on your history and conditioning and, you know, what your, you know, just whatever's next mm-hmm. for you. But if your commitment is there, then there'll be, you know, then the question will be, what do I start to take on next? How is that commitment going to manifest in specific actions mm-hmm. on a day-to-day basis? Yeah. Good. Well, thank you for listening.
Well,
more.
No, it's not. You don't need to record.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you a little more.